Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 143 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. UST Eastern Time on PRN.FM. Or download the program after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. We have another long interview this week, so let's get right to it. Dr. Judy Mikovits earned a B.A. in Chemistry and Biology from the University of Virginia in 1980 and a Ph.D. in Biochemistry and Molecular Biology from George Washington University in 1992. After that, she went to the National Cancer Institute in Frederick, Maryland, where she developed purification methods for interferon alpha. This was used in the first immune therapy treatment for hairy cell leukemia in 1986. She also worked at Upjohn Pharmaceuticals in Kalamazoo to develop production methods to ensure biological materials manufactured using human blood products were free of contamination from HIV-1. Dr. Mikovits in 2006 became attracted to the plight of families with neuroimmune diseases, including ME-CFS, a chronic fatigue syndrome, and autism, and was primarily responsible for demonstrating the relationship between environmentally acquired immune dysfunction, chronic inflammation, and these diseases. In 2001, she moved back to industry, where she directed the cancer biology program of Epigenics Pharmaceuticals. In 2006, she co-founded and developed the first neuroimmune research institute dedicated to understanding the pathophysiology of myelogenic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, and related illnesses. In 2009, doctors Rossetti and Mikovits' lab isolated for the first time a new family of human retroviruses, then identified as XMRV. In 2011, it was learned that this was a contaminant of the Silverman lab, and that the XMRVs Mikovits and Rossetti isolated were a new human retrovirus family. This new family of pathogenic human retroviruses is now called HDRV. Dr. Mikovits has most recently written the book Plague with co-author Kent Heckenlively, which covers a lot of the ground in her biography. Welcome to the show, Judy.
Thanks, Dave. It's nice to be here.
So you're a scientist and you ended up in jail, so you must have pissed off some awfully powerful people. Did you ever find out why you were arrested?
While I was held in jail, I was told I was a fugitive from justice. Mm-hmm. So in fact, the arrest was false, total false arrest. And yes, I did find out why, because you know, we caught some very powerful people committing some federal crimes that were, as we said in the book, crimes against humanity. We refused to back down from our data and when cover up what we found and the contamination of blood supply and vaccines. And the government had to do everything they could to make sure nobody ever saw the data, just as they covered it up in the case of what Andy Wakefield found with the MMR vaccine. Although the scientist in that story, Thompson, and the rest of the CDC scientists agreed to cover it up. So because I didn't cover it up, I ended up in jail.
The Thompson story is kind of interesting because for a while on a lawyer's website was basically a confessional from Thompson saying, we covered up an association between MMR and autism, at least in black boys, in that one group, which is a pretty big admission because the CDC has said absolutely false. Anybody who believes vaccines cause autism is a crackpot and should not be believed, but their own data actually showed that before it was sanitized.
Correct.
So let's start by talking about chronic fatigue syndrome, which has the almost unpronounceable name.
Myalgic.
Myalgic.
Encephalomyelitis. And okay. It means simply inflammation of the brain and muscles.
Okay. And myalgia is the muscle part.
Correct.
Encephalopathy is the brain part.
Okay.
Correct.
And they're both in itis, and they're both inflamed. Got it.
Right. So is there a universally agreed definition?
There's a university agreed exclusion definition. So it's a diagnosis of exclusion of everything else in a medical literature. and that becomes myalgic encephalomyelitis.
So I imagine that people who ended up diagnosed with CFS, let's call it that for simplicity, probably felt a little bit abandoned by the medical system because people would tell them, you don't have this, you don't have that. But how do we know that there's a single cause for what's kind of the leftover after other things have been eliminated?
There's certainly no single cause. And this is the big problem with complex diseases. This is a complex chronic, I call it an acquired immune deficiency, and that's why it's important for you to read that long-winded bio, because I've spent my entire life, almost 37 years since I graduated from UVA, studying acquired immune deficiencies. And so it's very clear that this is a complex chronic disease that progresses as different environmental insults hit. And so, of course, there's no single cause. So that's why we look at the entire family and consider the genetics, the epigenetics, what the environment has done to gene expression, and then what the current environmental stressors or toxins for the immune system that's already crippled are. And when we start breaking those down in each individual person, then we can affect good treatment. Then we can affect good treatment strategies. It's really just precision medicine in cancer. We don't know what causes cancer. So saying, we can't solve it until we know what causes it, that's ridiculous. We can treat it just as we treat cancer, which and autoimmune diseases, which are also acquired immune deficiencies.
Well, when you say we don't know what causes cancer, I mean, in some cases, we know, right?
No, like, we actually don't. In very few cases. So, for instance, let's use this definition of cause. You can smoke cigarettes and never get lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You can
99.9% of the HPV infections don't result in cervical cancer.
Right.
HPV does not cause cancer. The only virus that has actually been shown causative for a cancer, causative, that means every single case of this type of cancer known as adult T-cell leukemia is caused by the human retrovirus that Frank Rossetti first isolated in 1980 with Bernie Poise, called human T-cell leukemia virus at the time.
That's HTLV-1.
That's HTLV-1. Now, HTLV-1 is associated with any number of arthralgias, inflammatory diseases, lymphomas, but it's only causative for that one leukemia, because every single case of the disease has to have the virus in the person to be causative. So we, by that same definition, Peter Duisberg was right, 30 years ago, HIV does not cause AIDS. Because you can have HIV and not have AIDS.
But you wrote in your book that Robert Gallo proved you weren't very complimentary about Robert Gallo, but you did say he proved HIV causes AIDS, didn't you?
No. and this is the work. He didn't actually do anything, but lab workers and Luc Montagnier, they isolated HIV from AIDS patients, and they showed, they showed in the laboratory and in humans, HIV, you would die from from AIDS, the acquired immune deficiency associated with HIV. So most of the young men who and people who died would die of things like Kaposi sarcoma virus. And this is a really important point that you're touching on, because Kaposi sarcoma. And Kaposi sarcoma was just a disease like CFS, where they said, oh, we don't know what causes Kaposi sarcoma, but it was endemic in the southern tip of Italy. And so old men in the southern tip of Italy got Kaposi sarcoma. Well, when we isolated HIV from the young men who also had Kaposi sarcoma, at UCLA, 20-year-olds, they certainly weren't old men in Italy, that tells you that there's a virus somewhere, and this is when...
Well, why would you say there's a virus when there was the alternative theory that paupers were causing Kaposi sarcoma?
Well, because sometime in 1986 or 7, Patrick, I got Pat's last name, and they isolated Kaposi sarcoma virus, a herpes virus, and then could associate it with every case of Kaposi sarcoma. So again, they proved the causative thing that they actually, you know, decades after it, identified Kaposi sarcoma virus. It's now called human herpes virus 8. And so that was the co-infection. So when you have these acquired immune deficiencies, pathogens rarely, if ever, travel alone, because they have to cripple different parts of the immune system because it's very strong and redundant.
And so, what do you mean by isolation? Because HIV, for example, has never been purified.
Oh, yeah, HIV has been purified and
no.
isolated.
No, it's never been purified. What paper purified HIV?
Well, define your term purified.
Well, to separate, the simple definition of purification is to separate something from everything else, so that you end up with a sample that, apart from inert materials that obviously are necessary, the only thing you have in the sample is HIV, and that's just never been done.
Well, you can't do that because it comes from human cells. The provirus, human retroviruses, are proviruses, which just mean they're just DNA. So every part of the virus is human except for the DNA blueprint.
Well, you claim
it's actually an RNA blueprint that is reverse transcribed into DNA.
Right, I understand that.
So the term isolation to 98% purity of the proteins made by the virus, or the nucleic acid sequence. So the virus itself, the particle itself, that's the definition of retroviruses. You know, the cell does everything. So, but once the particle is made by the cell, the virus is isolated in away from the blood. We didn't just take the DNA out or the RNA or the expression. We took everything that was made from the cells.
Right, but
so
the
we
way
we isolated the envelope, we isolated the capsid. There's almost no other way to say it. A purified, isolated. You know, you do it to 98% purity. So HIV has certainly been isolated to 98% purity.
I'd like to see that paper, because I've been looking for it for a long time. What they did with HIV is they cultured it. You'll agree with that, right? They cultured it in a test tube.
They are we.
Okay,
you know, I was there in 1980.
So you cultured it in a test tube, and then you took the culture supernatant, the liquid over the culture, and you then filtered that and density centrifuged it, right? So you spin it at high speed until you get what you talked about was a pellet, right? Which is supposed to be the pure virus. But when that was put under an electron microscope in the late 1990s, they discovered it was at least 90% impurities. I mean, that's documented. Two papers in the Journal of Virology, I believe, in March 1997, that documented that the pellet was over 90% impurities.
Well, there's certainly a lot of impurities, but I would think it was 10% impurities and 90% viral protein. And by the way, you don't do it in a test tube.
Well,
we literally take the blood. We don't culture it in any other animal cell. when we isolate it from the blood. So what I do is I take the blood and I take the cells from the blood and I put it in a flask and I use decetabine and other chemicals to cause the virus to the cell to divide and the virus to come out of the cell, make the particles, translate the proteins, do whatever, do what viruses do, transcription, translation, in the case of retroviruses, reverse transcribe.
So
then that particle is, so yes, there are lots of plasma proteins in the plasma and pieces of cellular debris. Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, isolate to, we purified the proteins over various gradients and gels and isolated those and sequenced the entire protein. I mean, this wasn't a plasmid, but it's important for our discussion because you're quite right. You know, it's not a single virus. You don't isolate. This isn't this pure particle because they're proviruses. They're pieces of DNA.
But you wrote... I'm confused because you wrote about XMRV that you put it under an electron microscope and you verified that you had pure particles.
Yes. Well, we have in the mixture that you have pure particles, gamma retrovirus particles. So if you look at those pictures, we purified it, we spun it down, we took that, we sliced it across. You slice it across.
Right.
This is Kunio Nagashima, and he did all of the HIV electron micrographs as well. So you put it in the electron micrograph, and sure, you see a ton of debris in there, but you see whole particles, whole intact particles, and then of the debris in the cellular membrane, you see a thickening and a budding where the virus buds
okay.
out of the cell.
So I think we have different definitions of purification.
Exactly. I think we have different definitions.
Because I'm talking about, I mean, the term isolation comes from the Latin word isola or island, which means to separate something from everything else. An island is by itself. So when virologists talk about isolation or purification, they do not mean
right.
what a person on the street
right.
would mean. They do not mean,
correct.
Like, if I have pure gold, then
right.
I just have gold. Now, maybe there's some contamination and there's no such thing as 100% pure gold. But,
right.
Put that okay. aside, pretty much I've got pure gold. And that's what a chemist
right.
would say. Pure gold. Now, maybe you've got an element that can't be in air, so you have this element is in water, so it doesn't oxidize or something like that. But you're saying, okay, we still have the pure material surrounded
yeah,
by something in it.
You're exactly right in what you said. I mean, so what you said is scientists and lay people use different terms. And this is the challenge of writing this book. I don't know if you know, but my co-author, Kent Eckenlively, is a sixth grade science teacher. So he wrote the book from hours and hours of transcription.
Right.
We literally taped the book. And then he told the story and tried to tell the science. But you're exactly right. And this is how the public gets misled about things like, well, isolated up because scientists use a different terminology, and it's actually wrong. So when we say things, that's why we discuss causative, because the government and the public just says, oh, HPV causes cancer. It absolutely does not.
Mm-hmm,
and HIV
we'll
absolutely does not cause AIDS. And XMRV certainly doesn't cause chronic fatigue syndrome, but in our work, in Harvey Alter's work, in the Montoya samples, there are cohorts around the world where XMRV, HGRV, as I said, a human gamma retrovirus. This is a gamma retrovirus where that electron microscope can deduce the structure that of the phylogeny of gamma retroviruses related to mice. It's related to gibbon apes as well. It's related to a gamma retrovirus known as gibbon ape leukemia virus. It's related to one called DG75. We had all of that in the original paper. So and you're exactly right.
So I have another
lots
question.
Lots of viruses associated with CFS, retroviruses,
right.
For now 30 years. And every time it's been buried, and this population of millions has been left to suffer, and they, like we discussed as you opened the show, you know, are you kidding me? 30, 40 years now we have to find the cause. When we all agree that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, and yet we spend millions, trillions of dollars, you know, investigating the co-infection.
It's almost like facts don't matter. And, of course, the mainstream scientists and mainstream media always talk about fake news, but sometimes they perpetrate much grander fakes. It's kind of like my analysis of the difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. It's like Donald Trump was like the the shyster on the corner with some little game, and Hillary Clinton was the one who had the really big game on. You know, Mr. Big sitting in the mansion, pulling the strings of thousands of people. But I think a lot of big science, once you have a theory that's accepted by the public, you can generate billions of dollars worth of revenue from that. But I have a question, okay? So we agree now that we've got very different definitions of isolation purification. So we have a material that we can verify under the electron microscope. There's a lot of stuff from the cell culture, from whatever other materials, if you take it directly from the blood, whatever. And within that, there are some particles. So how do you determine what is the genetic and protein components of those particles when they're actually not separated? The vast bulk of what's under the electron microscope is something else. So how do you know that what you have is viral proteins and viral
for what we did in the paper, and the most sensitive ways to do that is we use immune precipitation. So your antibodies are so specific in your body, and this is the whole idea of vaccine damage by these viruses. So you will, you know, you will be able to pull out, it's called immune precipitation. You literally, it's like taking a magnet, putting in and putting an antibody right down into the gamish, and it is a gamish, you're absolutely right, and pulling out that protein. And then you blot it on a filter, and then you come back at it with a second antibody that recognizes a different part of that same protein.
Okay, so no, it doesn't matter which virus we're talking about. Let's say we're talking about XMRV. So you're saying you take an antibody to XMRV, and you put it, say, with somebody's blood and see what it attaches to.
And it's called immune precipitation.
Okay, so
you take an antibody in the laboratory to a mouse virus. So you take a rat antibody. We had a whole panel, hundreds of antibodies to all different family members of mouse-related gamma retroviruses. So the antibody is the antibody to the envelope, the known protein from the database of that envelope protein from that mouse.
And how did you get that protein in order to generate the antibody in the mouse? Where did that protein come from?
From 40 years of the viruses growing in the mouse. So Sandy Rossetti, on our original paper, Frank Rossetti's wife, is a mouse virologist. We were human virologists. So we're working in the lab every day in every lab with mice. And so basically the big oh my God in the realization in 2011, where there were lots of these viruses that were coming out of mice with crippled genomes, because that's what cancer scientists do. They cripple the genomes of the mice so they can study the acquired immune deficiencies in cancer.
Right.
So we make mouse models of everything. So the mouse in the early 80s, Sandy Rossetti was studying the mouse viruses, and she made the antibody.
Right,
that's hybridoma.
I got a logical question. So we have an antibody.
Okay, fine.
So you have an antibody to a mouse virus. We put with some human materials, and it latches onto some proteins. Okay, so how did we find those proteins? Well, we found them in mice without purifying the virus in the way that I want a virus purified, which is just the virus. So don't we have the same problem in the mouse studies, that we're taking a protein out of some materials that is not 100% virus? It also contains other things.
Correct. And the way you correct for that is you compete. You compete. You do competition studies with purified protein where it was made recombinantly. So this is the whole point of how stringent our data were in the paper, because we recognize the gamish and everything else. And so we did competition studies. It's literally in our original papers to say we recognize this is called molecular mimicry when you have cross-contamination with another protein. So, but the, and that's why we used panels of different antibodies. We used one of our antibodies is called 7C10, and that's a monoclonal antibody. That means it recognizes a single clone, and it recognizes all known xenotropic and polytropic retroviruses. So that means it recognizes the whole family of viruses, and that's why in the bio it's a family of viruses. And again, it's the proteins are shown to be toxic. The peptides are shown to be toxic. And the big oh my God in our discoveries was, of course, this is what this debris, this everything is what is in our vaccine. And now we know, and now we know they're generating recombinant viruses every day, 7 days in that vat that we grow our vaccines in at the, you know, in every single company that uses a mouse culture system is now generated and these people are, you know, 25 million Americans. 6% of America is a carrier now of a virus that was introduced into people through vaccines or a contaminated blood supply.
Yeah, to finish the discussion of isolation and purification, is it fair to say that every virus experiment depends on previous virus experiments, because you're using the materials, the proteins that were generated, say in studying mice, are used as probes in human materials, and so therefore, your studies on the humans are as good as the mouse virus studies.
Well, that's true, but we also you're leaving out recombinant technology. So when you know the exact sequence of the genes and the recombinant technology, these hybridomas are shown to detect only one protein structure.
Right.
They're not all sequenced, they're conformational, and that's why you make a panel. So of course, you know, your experiments are in human, any experiment is only as good as your reagent. And what was significant about our experiments is nobody had a broader, deeper depth of reagents to identify all the diversity. And that's why it was easy for people to say, oh, it's not there, because what we discovered was something so much bigger.
But to look for genetic materials, how do you determine?
No, we look for proteins.
You're looking for proteins.
We look for, yes. And we look for genetic similarities, and that's what's called a phylogenetic analysis. So you'll sequence peptides across many, many, many different samples. And what I showed you, in a lot of my talks, was one of the things we did in our studies was we cloned individual cells from the same person, and then sequence individual viruses out of the same person, and we did it with more than one person to show that our viruses that we were isolating, and I appreciate the differences in using to partially purifying the viruses were not the lab contaminants. So we could do the sequences precise enough when you take an individual clone.
So when you
take one individual clone and grew the viruses from that cell, and we did that across hundreds so that we could get some statistics to what the closest sequence of the virus was.
So you're detecting proteins. So the probe you use for the proteins is not the entire protein, obviously.
No, correct.
Right. So it's a partial.
It's a sequence. But it's done recombinantly. When you make a monoclonal antibody, you use the recombinant technology so that the sequence comes from the original mouse studies. But of course, in human studies, but of course there's diversity. There are single nucleotide polymorphisms, And right. some affect the protein function and some don't.
So how many proteins are made up of amino acids, right?
Yeah. So in the case of, and I have to go back and look, so a retrovirus is about 8 kilobases of RNA transcribed
right.
into DNA. The provirus is about 8 kilobases.
Right.
And so we know that translates into a 100 nanometer particle
right.
with all the proteins and everything there. And we know, so for instance, the envelope gene that makes that envelope, the coat on the virus, is about 1,000 nucleotides. And so there are 3 nucleotides to an amino acid. So in our case, we got pieces of the virus as large as 700 of the envelope protein. And it's that envelope that really, the outer coat, the outer thing is what the cell sees.
How big are your
probes?
So
that does most of the damage.
How big are your probes?
How big are our probes?
Like how many amino acids? I mean, how do you
300?
300.
I mean, we transcribe a lot of, and some of them are the entire, proteins. We've transcribed all of them, the P15, the P8, the P3. So you express them recombinantly and you make them and so in the case of the National Cancer Institute, where I did all of these viruses, all of these families of viruses, HTLVs, HIVs, there are dozens of HTLVs. And they're, significantly different enough. And only the HTLV 1 and 2 are really associated with any diseases. So, this is really...
Well, HTLV 2 was found in one person.
Yes, anything we call, actually, it's not just one person, but you're really touching on key points because this is why, when we talk about, the science being settled. You've got cell lines. You've got zero monkey kidney cells, which make retroviruses, which make gamma retroviruses, which make HIV-like retroviruses, lentiviruses, which make beta retroviruses. This is the beta retrovirus is associated with a primary biliary cirrhosis. So you've got all of these associations and all of these diseases and all of these pieces and parts of viruses, recombining
right.
because of the enzymes you're using. And these end up being injected with heavy gene toxifiers like an aluminum
right.
and methylation inhibitors into our immune compromised infants, old people, and teenagers.
I'm interested in the protein probes. Like I understand mm-hmm. that in many cases antibody tests are used, but you made the point that with XMRV or HTRV, mm-hmm. antibodies appear to be a sign of resistance, which is logical. Because
yeah.
that's what antibodies are supposed to be, which kind of calls
right.
the HIV antibody testing into question. You would think that people who had a positive HIV antibody test would be immune, but put that aside.
Well, actually, but the cell-mediated immunity is really important. And so some people make a lot of antibodies. They make autoantibodies. They make things that do different things, and we're only scratching the surface on different forms of antibodies. You have 4 subclasses. So, yeah, there are very different responses depending on where the protein is made. Like in the gut, you'll get all IgA antibodies because there are certain, and I'm not an expert on antibodies, but at any rate, you're right. You'll get a lot of different things. So it's really important to recognize the variation, and this is why, the studies never should have been stopped because there were clear, 80%. In all 3 studies, when you use the right patient population, and these people are desperately ill with lots of diseases, lots of co-infections, lots of cancers, their families are destroyed. And yet we don't even look at it. We won't even look at it.
You're talking about CFS. You're talking about CFS now?
Yeah, I'm talking about the people we found XMRV, not only CFS, we found it in ITP. Idiopathic thrombocytopenia is a fatiguing illness that's actually blood disease, where you don't make the megakaryocytes, you don't make the right clotting cells. And so this particular blood disease, that James Bucel is the expert in the world, and you'll find that in the book. So we went with our antibody test to detect the antibodies, the people who had the antibodies, and two different kind of protein tests. So we always did two or three tests. And so we went with James Bucel's, and we identified it in 30% of everything that's called ITP.
I want to
MMR injury.
I want to pin down the protein tests. So I understand antibody tests because you have antibodies and antigens. So you can put an antibody in a sample to pick up an antigen or vice versa. And with DNA, you can put in the negative DNA as a probe in PCR to pull out the DNA that you're looking for. But what's the equivalent with proteins? Like, how do you find
that
a protein in a sample?
That is an antigen in an antibody. Antigens and antibodies are proteins.
Okay, so a protein is basically, it doesn't really matter if it's an antigen or an antibody. So you have an antibody, so a protein is basically an antigen. So it's an antigen test, right? And so you're trying to find an antibody. Okay, and so you're saying that the proteins were present, but not necessarily antibodies.
Correct. And that may be because the proteins, some of the proteins, you know, the person's immune system is crippled and can't make IgG or IgA, can't make IgG subclass 1, and we're actually finding this. They're called common variable immune deficiencies. We're finding these patients literally can't make the antibody. And that's what, you know, there are hypotheses about. There are many, many, many B-cell defects in AIDS patients and in CFS patients. They look the same and, you know, similar over a family, if you will. Common variable immune deficiency and B-cell issues are a big part of HIV AIDS. They're a big part of HTLV AIDS. They're a big part of ME-CFS, XMRV AIDS, which we call myalgic encephalomyelitis.
If we can, I'd like to talk a little bit about the history of CFS. You talked about how it was first discovered in 1934 in L.A., and there was at a hospital. It only affected the hospital workers, and there was a suspicion that it was related to an experimental polio vaccine developed by a Canadian scientist called Brody. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, those the studies actually were developing vaccines, and in order to attenuate the pathogens, the viruses, they were passing. That means they were injecting mouse brains, and in order to, you know, make an antibody or proteins attenuate the virus, because the immune system is made to inactivate viruses that are foreign. So this is how we make vaccines. We attenuate. We make them weaker. We use the cowpox instead of smallpox because it's similar enough for the immune system to make some immediate antibodies, that is, proteins, to recognize it, so that should you see it again, your immune system's ready with at least some form of defense and arsenals. So essentially, Chapter 5 was very interesting, and it stands alone in Kent Tech and Lively's investigation. It wasn't the first cases of ME-CFS in the world. Those were in the 50s over in the UK, in the 20s over in the UK. And here, this was the 30s, and those people doing the experiments, Brody, trying to make vaccines, poliovirus vaccines, were injecting the material, the unpurified material, everything you've talked about in the last hour, directly into mouse brains, grinding up the mouse tissue, and whatever comes out the other end, gets semi-purified. That means they get as much crap out of it as they can and make it just the pure antigen or just the viral protein that they want, or just the killed, semi-beat-up virus that doesn't replicate as fast or kill the cells as easily.
And then they put it back in another mouse brain and do the same thing?
They put it into humans.
So they didn't passage it through multiple mouse brains?
Not at that time. It's pretty detailed in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have one in front of me, but
right.
You know, and this wasn't my research. This was Kent's research.
Yeah.
As far, I mean, and again, but I came to CFS from cancer in eight.
Right.
And I looked at it always as an acquired immune deficiency, which it is.
Right. So I mean, it was kind of interesting to me the slapdash nature of the research. Like they injected this experimental polio vaccine to a few lab workers, and then they started injecting it into children.
Exactly.
which seems slightly
which boggles the mind.
Irresponsible.
And what happened was a lot of people got sick. The doctors and the nurses and their families got sick. So the government paid them off, and this is where you have to appreciate the parallel of what's happening today.
Right.
And that's why the big oh my God in chapter whatever of our book, when we showed all the data, because that was exactly what was happening. The Silverman's lab workers, whatever came out of the vat, you know, when he cloned the virus. So he actually put the pieces together and asked the fake enzyme to write it in a test tube, like you said. And that's the big difference. That wasn't what was in humans. But what he actually did, their work was so sloppy that he infected his lab workers. So when we were doing the testing and we were using our antibody, and we were finding many, many, many lab workers were infected, and many, many, many lab workers were getting sick. I mean, and I mean cancers, CFS, multiple sclerosis, lupus, their kids had autism. So the lab workers, because we're the front line, are the ones that, and basically we were seroconverting. We were making antibodies to the viral protein, envelope protein, that outside coat protein. And what that means is we've been exposed.
Well, how do you balance the concerns of, like, obviously you have concerns about vaccines being contaminated with viruses, but you also talk about environmental toxins. And, of course, vaccines include mercury and aluminum and many other foreign compounds that also could be potential causes of vaccine damage.
And absolutely. So I focus on retroviruses because that's my expertise. But what we found in 1993 with DNA methylation, the epigenetics,
mm-hmm.
that's why that's in the bio. What we found was the heavy metals, or the metals, the aluminum, the arsenic. You know, we use arsenic trioxide, so they demethylate genes. So they change the gene expression. So the
right.
aluminum is actually contributing to the retroviruses and all the gene dysregulation by allowing them, by preventing the macrophages and tumor suppressor genes and the various immune pathways from silencing the retrovirus. So this is what my important paradigm shifting discovery was in HIV/AIDS with Magic Johnson, and that is you have to silence the retrovirus as soon as possible, and you don't vaccinate them at all. You don't put any kind of metal, because this is demethylated arsenic trioxide. You know, that's how it's a cancer cure. So in arsenic's in our waters. Arsenic was in the water in Nevada. Nevada is the silver state. So whenever you find heavy metal, then you're causing the aberrant expression not only of your retroviruses but other pathogens like the Lyme, like EBV, like all the associated pathogens, and then they just have a little war with your immune system. In your immune system, think about it as being just everybody's held, all your troops are held in jail. So the aluminum is surrounding and crippling your dendritic cells, your frontline defense, and you can do nothing. And so your immune system is just sitting there. So, yes, and I don't discount them. They're contributing, and this is what we found in HIV/AIDS. If you keep the virus silent, the men never get
well,
AIDS.
Well, let's talk about Magic Johnson. There was an expression around mm-hmm. that time when he was first diagnosed. I don't know if it was the 1990s, I think.
It was November 7, 1991 when it was announced.
There was an expression, there's no magic in AZT, and there's no AZT in magic. Like, you seem to be assuming that Magic Johnson took antiretroviral drugs, but how can we actually know that?
Well,
He later promoted antiretroviral drugs. Like, he was a spokesman, for Coletra.
What I knew about it was I defended my PhD thesis a week after they described that. And what we had learned at that time was the T cell wasn't the gut one that was going to kill the patient. It was expression from the monocyte. So we had to change the way we treated it. And at that time, I showed the mechanisms of how highly active antiretroviral therapy, if used early, would silence expression of the virus, would allow the methylation machinery and the immune system to do its job and keep a homeostasis balance and clear the virus. So all I know is that Magic Johnson went to David Ho, who was also on the cover of Time magazine,
right, 1996.
The next year or so. Uh-huh. And sought treatment. And David Ho was our colleague doing, you know, those treatments with those therapies, and that I guess that there's an assumption that since, you know, he never developed AIDS, that he actually considered therapies or gene silencing technologies that affected the macrophage.
I mean, he might also have had a financial reason. He was the spokesperson for Combivir, which is not a protease inhibitors. It's a combination of AZT and lamivudine, which are both nucleoside analogs, which are the original class of AIDS drugs.
Well,
and
correct. But if you silence expression, then you silence the protein, by definition.
And then he was the spokesperson for Coletra, which may include that was an Abbott drug, which may include a protease inhibitor. But, I mean, obviously, if he wasn't taking drugs and he was a spokesman for the drug companies, he wasn't going to admit that he wasn't taking drugs.
Right.
I mean, what is your thought of AZT?
AZT, I know how it works, and if used low dose in a combination therapy with to protect other parts of the immune system, I know it can use low dose in combination with methylation inhibitors. I know it can start to cure adult T-cell leukemia, which is one of the most horrific diseases ever. So I think parts, you know, AZT was developed as a cancer drug. There are many nucleoside analogs that stop reverse transcriptase and stop expression of the virus
Nucleoside analogs, I mean, they, DNA is formed from four bases, right? A, C, G, T, and AZT is an analog for thymidine, which is
correct.
One of the four bases.
Correct.
So a molecule of AZT will stop an entire chain of DNA from dividing, from replicating, correct?
Correct.
And so that it will do that for regular DNA. It doesn't have to be a viral RNA. Or it doesn't have to be the viral RNA trying to get into the DNA that's stopped. It could be any DNA that's replicating.
Right, yeah.
And that's what makes nucleoside analogs.
That's what makes it toxic.
Right, that's what makes it so toxic. Plus, the amount of DNA, of your DNA in a cell, is vastly greater than the amount of viral material. So the target, you know, if you've got a molecule of AZT, it's more likely to encounter your DNA than it is viral DNA, viral RNA trying to become DNA. Isn't that
right.
true? So
right, but exactly. But and that's what highly active antiretroviral therapy was: a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and a little. It was a combination of five different things, recognizing and using the lower the dose you use each of them, the less toxicity you have. Because what you're going to do, I mean, this is the whole idea of chemotherapy, you know, kill the cancer cell, theoretically grow dividing faster than the blood cell, but not much. So that's why you do all the hematopoietic damage. And this is exactly, you know, that was chemotherapy.
But there's,
you know,
never
so
really
yes,
been,
it's toxic.
Like, you're talking about reducing the dose, but the lowest possible dose, of course, is a placebo of no dose. And the only placebo-controlled trials of AIDS drugs were of AZT, and it's pretty well documented that those trials were completely corrupted by both the drug companies and the patients who did things like sharing their pills and things like that. So there's really never been a placebo-controlled trial of AIDS drugs. So how do we know that if we reduced the dose to zero, we wouldn't get better results?
Well, I guess we don't, but you're always thinking of it in a combination therapy. So, you know, that's why you do the experiments. But, I mean, and we worked with, obviously with Candace Pert, and not, maybe not obviously, but maybe you've read her book, Molecules of Emotion, or seen The Healing Field, or seen the Dallas Buyers Club, where, of course, at the time in 1986, we were using peptide therapy, peptide T, to just compete the peptides for the interactions with the immune cells. And that's detailed in the book, the role we played at that. So we, in drug development, we, you know, we were faced with a situation in the 80s where young men and people were literally dropping like flies. So we just took things off the shelf to see, understand the mechanisms. We didn't understand the mechanisms of these therapies in cancer either, and we still don't. So, you know, and that's when we don't understand them in vaccines, which are immune therapy as well. We still don't. We still don't know all the off-target effects. But when you're faced with, we've got to stop the replication of that virus and suppress the overactive immune system with steroids. Magic Johnson did take steroids. You can look at his face.
Right.
We've got two things, many, many things going into the disease. You've got an overactive immune system. It's like a wheel spinning where it can't clear all the debris you were talking about. It can't,
right.
You know,
but
the cells are freaked out and they can't clear all that crap.
One thing you didn't talk about was that at the time when AIDS was supposedly discovered in gay men in 1981, the target, the fast track gay man living in the inner city areas where people felt comfortable expressing their gay identity, there was a huge drug problem, especially with poppers, which still goes on today, which is carcinogenic and immunosuppressive. So
absolutely.
How can we say a virus was the cause of their illness and that we needed to get rid of the virus and then everybody would be okay doing poppers, doing all the other drugs that were commonly used in the bathhouses?
Well, you know, we again, we didn't. That's why I say environmental toxins. That's why I say other things. Yes, we were looking at the poppers because what they do is they cripple your cells.
Mm-hmm.
If the aluminum in the vaccines cripples primarily your macrophages because they're the frontline defense in your dendritic cells, then they can't work to tell the T cells what to do. That's the cell-mediated adaptive immune response. Your front line is your innate immune response.
And so you're saying that the toxins allow the viruses to do their dirty work.
And vice versa.
But have disease without the virus? Like if you have toxins, can't you just have toxins that cause disease?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because they cause the same gene expression.
Interesting.
But we also have 13% of our genome is regulatory RNA and pieces and parts of best old retroviruses that express proteins that can hurt us. This is autoimmune disease, autoantibodies. This is why all our kids are sick, because before their immune system has the communication down as an adult, while it's looking for those environmental toxins, we're crippling their ability to do their job even before they get started.
True
vaccines.
So they
start out through vaccines,
right,
from all the stuff we're talking about. You know, it's designed, your immune system's designed to see one molecule. Just like you said, when you get all the way down to one molecule, how do you know that wasn't placebo? And placebo is a very real innate immunity that is being crippled by all these toxins and by injection after injection after injection.
We've had a pretty interesting discussion, and I can't believe that we're pushing towards the end of our time. So now I'd like to give you a chance to wrap things up by tell my listeners why they should read your book Plague, or maybe there's some other things you wanted to get out that you haven't got out. We still got a couple of minutes before we need to wrap.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think our discussion tells you why you should read Plague, because, you know, science is never settled. We can debate even HIV, even 37, 40 years later from what people called the cause. Once we start recognizing start recognizing that other things cause similar crippling diseases. And of course, we don't know what causes all the cancer, and we can see the toxins in our world. So you should read Plague to understand how, when you watch TV, the propaganda around, the hepatitis C commercials and testing and all, Zika, you'll start to realize, how can they say cause? You know, and
yes.
How can they ignore all the toxins in the world?
Well, if you disagree with them and say, I think vaccines cause autism, they'll be all over you. You can't say it's causative just because you know a girl who had the vaccine and the next day she got sick. That's not cause, right? But they use the word cause all the time.
Correct, with the exact same complaints. They're exactly right. So this was a really important conversation, Dave, because people, the cause. You know, we never said, if you go back to the original paper, we never have ever said anything causes anything, even HIV. We just look at the people because, like you said, not only were they doing the poppers, but they had mycoplasma. They were in moldy buildings. They were in smoking cigarettes. There was a whole lot to the people that died the fastest.
Right,
so
and of course,
you can live with HIV and never, ever, ever get AIDS.
And it's important to understand that there were many gay men who lived healthy lives. Many did not do drugs. And it's really, I think, the difference between the gay community and the straight community is that the drugs were different. Like, poppers are pretty much a gay drug. But it's not like heterosexuals don't do drugs, right? There's a huge problem.
Right.
We now see that with the opioid epidemic. That is largely, you might say, a heterosexual epidemic. And so the symptoms you see from opioids, of course, are different than the symptoms you see from poppers.
Absolutely. And it's when we can look at everything in our environment. The point is 1 in 3, and by 2020, 1 in 2, and our kids are getting sicker and sicker, and at least part of it is injecting pieces of DNA and other viruses and other microbes into our children and our families, or mandating.
Yeah, I think it has to end somewhere. I mean, we can't get to 1 in 2 boys being autistic. America is just going to, especially America, because they have the most vaccines of anybody, America is just going to collapse.
America is going to collapse. And girls at puberty, that's why you don't, that's all your chronic disease.
Right, and now we can give them HPV when they're young girls and we can finish them off.
And we can finish them off. Exactly right.
Yes. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I wish we had another hour to continue this discussion.
Well, hopefully in the future we can.
Thank you for listening to episode 143 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. You can commit to a monthly donation.